Hello, America. This is the place for uncensored talk on everything that divides us as a nation. I'm Alan Jacoby, and welcome to The Great Divide. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Great Divide podcast. I am your host, Alan Jacoby. Today, I have a very special guest. It's Karen Turk, who is former Mrs. Florida 2016. She's a conservative activist and a host of a conservative talk show called Behind the Headlines. Karen also has a tell-all book that's going to be coming out in October called Behind the Headlines, which is how a conservative beauty queen became a target of fake news and cancel culture. Karen, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I haven't been canceled here yet, so that's the good news.
Karen, we will never be canceled. They will not silence people like us. It will never happen. And you will continue to launch your truth bombs.
I will. You know, I started saying about a year ago, they can lock me up, but they can't shut me up. And that's been my mantra ever since.
100%. So, Karen, you have a pretty amazing story. I want to start. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your politics, what led you to you have an extensive career in media. Let's give us some background.
I do. You know, I had a career before politics. You know, I've always been interested in politics. I've always considered myself a Republican. I mean, way back to when I was a kid and Ronald Reagan was running against Jimmy Carter, and my parents were Democrats, and, you know, they thought it was a nice little party trick that they had this conservative Republican daughter. And, you know, I saw things logically back then. And, you know, as my parents got older, and especially as my father got older, he became more and more conservative because he had realized that the party that they thought had their back, the Democrat Party, had completely abandoned the tradition that it once held. And my parents started to sway over to the other side of the aisle, much to my delight. And I only wish that they would have really been around to see Donald Trump become president, because, you know, he really, you know, took a hit at the establishment, and establishment politics is part of the reason we have this great divide in our country and why we've had so many problems that we do. And I started talking politics, you know, as soon as I saw Donald Trump come down the escalator. I had very fortunately won the title of Mrs. Florida, which was not something that I would have ever thought I would do. I'm not a pageant girl. I'm a girl who grew up in New Jersey in a Jewish family, and pageants were not in my, you know, in my wheelhouse. But I actually went to a charity event, and I met this amazing woman who had been a former Mrs. Florida. And she said to me, you know, all the charity work you're doing, all the soapboxing you're doing, imagine if you competed and won this pageant, you'd have this tremendous opportunity to speak on behalf of the charities you represent and do all these amazing things. And, you know, initially it became really part of an extension of my philanthropic work. And I thought, okay, this will be an opportunity. I'm adopted. I thought I would go and advocate for, you know, adopted and foster care children, which was a cause that was really important to me. And just as I won, Donald Trump came down the escalator, and I started to speak on behalf of the things that I really believed in, which was freedom in America. And some people really liked it, and apparently some people really disliked it.
Well, yeah. I mean, now, especially in the political climate now, I mean, once the establishment realized that, you know, Donald Trump, he's running for president, and then when he became the Republican front runner and candidate, you know, the establishment went crazy. They were, what are we going to do? It was panic mode. It was, all right, we have to launch the attack. We have to start the attack. And then that's when the whole attack on conservatism in general really amped up and started. Obviously, you know, you were a victim of it. And it amazes me that even right now, we are considered conservatives the bad guys in this country for that narrative. And that media, that the days of objective journalism is over. I mean, obviously, I don't think that'll ever come back. And the fanning of the flames of the hatred towards Donald Trump and anybody who might have wore a red MAGA hat or is a Republican, is a conservative. And boom, here we are, people like us who aren't afraid to speak out, who have a voice and have a platform to do it. It's important because media, and like you've said in a few of your videos that I've watched, they just want the headlines, and they love the headlines that will make people like you and I look like garbage, you know? And they ran you through the ringer, right?
Yeah, they sure did. And, you know, and as much as I've been in media and you think you're prepared, and, you know, I've handled crisis management for a lot of high profile clients. I've been in this world for a long time, but, you know, I never really understood it fully until it happens to you. And, you know, my fight was really personal. My fight stemmed from a very litigious, contentious argument that I was having with a nursing home that I felt was not caring properly for my mother. And I felt she was being neglected, and I stood up and I fought back against them. And because of that, I left myself open to, you know, have this attack launched on me. And in some ways, I was a perfect target, being a conservative commentator and being somebody who was very publicly supporting our president. It made it very easy for the people that were against me to get the leftist media to have this mob media mentality and come after me. And, you know, if you read the headlines about me now, I sound like a total monster. I sound like this, you know, this woman that, you know, didn't care about her mom, that stole from her mother, and her mother had dementia. And, you know, there are bits and pieces of truth in this story, but overwhelmingly, this story is ridiculously untrue. I'm a daughter who stood up against a litigious guardianship system that took my mother hostage, stripped her of her rights. I unfortunately allowed some of that to happen because I was naive to the system, and I certainly know better now, but, you know, hindsight's 2020. That's one of the things I say in my book, and it really was 2020. 2020 was really the year of hindsight for me.
Yeah.
Because it's when everything came together and I realized just really how wrong I was and some of the decisions I had made, but I wouldn't trade it for the world, because I really do truly believe that everything happens for a reason. And the more salacious and the more crazy the headlines got, the more they made me look like a monster, yeah, the more people were like, wait a second, something's not adding up. A $17,000 misdemeanor? She spent 30 days in a maximum security prison? Wait, why does every headline say Roger Stone? Why does everybody have to mention that she's a Republican? Wait a minute, there must be more to this story. So, you know, I think really the attacks that they waged on me, just like they've waged so many attacks on other conservatives, they went so far, they pushed it so far that it actually ended up helping me get my story told. And ultimately, it's also my mother's story. And it's really important that we have this conversation in America about civil rights and about guardianship. And I'm so happy that movies like I Care a Lot, which just came out on Netflix, and the Free Britney movement are finally shedding light on this huge problem we have nationally, where 1.5 million people are put into guardianships, and many of them don't belong there. Many of them, this is a pay-for-play scheme, and the only people profiting are attorneys, and it's at the expense of the elderly.
Aren't the guardianship, and I was very intrigued. I was watching a few of your videos where you explained on how that worked. And I didn't realize that you had made mention, I believe there's a Netflix documentary about it that you mentioned. I forget what it is. Is it called The Guardian?
There's a Netflix documentary called The Guardian, which is a tremendous documentary that, because it's, you know, it's a real story of a couple out in Las Vegas that this happened to. And this actually came out before the movie I Care a Lot, and it did get some recognition and attention. I think actually it's on Amazon Prime. It's not on Netflix.
Okay.
But I Care a Lot gotten so much attention because it's, you know, more of, you know, a sort of dark comedy that reaches the mainstream. But I think a lot of people have realized, like, hey, this is true. This is really happening.
What amazed me was the part where, you know, when you were mentioning that a complete stranger can somehow manipulate and get guardianship over somebody. Mm-hmm. And obviously that there has to be the long game. It's finances and the attorneys, like you had said. And it just seems like this big conspiracy, and the victims are like these elderly people who may have dementia or Alzheimer's, and their cognitive decline is severe, and they're just in the middle, and they have their whatever it is, their Social Security or estates, and I would imagine it happens a lot within families too. Like I'm an only child, but I've seen families where, you know, it's five or six kids and the parents are on that decline and they pass away. And then like for estates, it's an all out war. Now the family hates each other and it's a fight. I don't know if I could equate the two, but I feel like this guardianship thing is like legal kidnapping.
It is. It thrives. Yeah. It thrives on vulnerability. And you brought up a really great point. I'm also an only child. And I was the problem only child that was in the way. I was making too much noise and I was exposing the nursing home for neglecting my mom, and they couldn't have that. And as I started to realize that something was really wrong and there was a lot of this, I'm going to call it collusion because that's the only word I can find for it, I really wanted to rip the lid off of it and expose it. And obviously, you know, their way of, you know, taking a shot at me was to cancel culture me, make me look like a criminal. So I would shut up and sit down. And unfortunately, they didn't know me very well, because that just makes me angrier and just makes me want to tell my story even more, especially because, you know, my mom was a civil rights activist. My mom was somebody that spent her entire life fighting for other people. And I now feel that this is in some way part of her legacy. And I have to, because I have to learn to deal with it and I have to rise above it. And that brings me peace to know that my mom is behind me sort of fighting this system. But yeah, a person can be taken out of their home by somebody that they don't know, who can be appointed as their guardian. In many cases, they have the siblings that you brought up, and they'll make the siblings fight with each other. And once they can create that environment of tension, they can say, the lawyers can step in and they can go, wait, this family can't get along. Let's go ahead and appoint this professional guardian, because these kids can't deal with each other. And it's a very easy play for them to appoint a guardian in that situation. When they have somebody like me or you, an only child, it's a little bit more difficult. But hey, if they can string the child up like a criminal and use prosecution, then they get the same effect overall as they would with creating that strife between siblings. And we've seen many cases across the country where they've used the same type of prosecution they use towards me against other people. You know, my situation was unique in some ways, but it was not so unique in others. And I felt very alone when this was happening to me, but I now realize that there are a lot of other only children that have been Turked, and we've coined the term Turked. And that's when you are, you know, prosecuted in order to allow a guardianship to happen and for the attorneys to make money. And, you know, the only people at the end of the day that profit here are the lawyers. And if I could go back and know what I know now, I would have handled everything obviously completely differently.
Sure.
But I feel like I'm in a really strong and unique position to send a message to the rest of the country. And I want to fight for federal legislation on this. I don't think the states are doing a good job of policing it. I think we need federal oversight and federal legislation. This entire system needs to be ripped apart.
It's just the whole elder care system. I despise nursing homes. I think it's, you know, it's you call it pay for play. It's all for profit. And I used to see it firsthand. I was an emergency medical technician in New York City for quite a while. And I used to get emergency calls in nursing homes. From the staff to the administration, it's all about money. And it's really disgusting. Karen, I would walk into nursing homes. We would get an emergency 911 call for a cardiac arrest. We would get on the way to the call, they would tell us CPR is in progress. Now, when I was new, you know, the adrenaline was going, all right, they're pumping and they're blowing and they're doing CPR on some woman or man in the nursing home, probably at the end stage of their life. Then we would get into the nursing home and we would be walking down the hallway to the room and we would see aides, not nurses. They'd have a lookout to see when we would show up, come out of the elevator, and they would run. And I saw firsthand several times. Now, it would take us 4 to 5 minutes to get there and then get our equipment and get up to the floor. They weren't doing CPR. They were standing at the bedside, not doing anything. And when they saw us, they started doing that CPR and that basic life-saving technique that we think is going since they found the person in cardiac arrest. No, they're waiting for us to come and they put on a show and then we're doing it. And 9 times out of 10, they're gone. We're pronouncing them dead in the bed in the nursing home. And I've had fights with these people. Like, how do you get away with this? You know, it's something that there's so much with nursing homes and elder care and insurance, and that you could blow the lid off of it. And this thing with you, I read some of those headlines, and yeah, it made you look like you were the worst person in the world. And from what I understand, this technicality of, you know, they accused you of stealing your mother's social security checks, and you were paying with it was a technicality of paperwork. It sounded like you were trying to pay right for services and something with a date of the paper, and they screwed you. And they were going to find
something. Let's call it what it is. They were going to find something. They were going to dig through my records and they were going to find something to nail me with. It didn't matter. And I knew that the moment I sat down to talk to this prosecutor, I knew that she was going to go through every bit of paper until she could find something. And, you know, all this nursing home, the attorneys, the guardian, the prosecutor, they were all in bed together. This was all an incestuous orgy. It really was. And that's my opinion. That's how I see it. And I will forever have my eyes opened on how just corrupt the amount of friendships and people that know each other and the favors that are done. And it was just absolutely obvious from day one that they were going to do anything that they could to shut me up and to nail me with something, because my mom was dying. My mom had 9 bed sores all over her body. I had called the state ombudsman. I had been complaining. I was making way too much noise. And they really wanted that situation to not be exposed. And guess what? None of the papers talked about it. None of the papers talked about the fact that I had an unlawful death suit against the nursing home after my mom died with 9 bed sores all over her body.
Oh my God.
There was nothing I could do. My rights were completely stripped from me. I couldn't help my mother. My mother was laying there dying and nobody would help me. Nobody would listen because I had no legal rights at that point. So, you know, it's really amazing that nobody talked about that. Now, right now, I'm in the middle of the nursing home was trying desperately to settle the lawsuit. It'll remain to be seen whether or not we go to a jury trial. I'm not sure how that's going to happen right now. And I'm not gagged on it, so I can still tell you about it. So that is still going on. And on top of that, another thing that the papers didn't talk about is the fact that all of the money that I owed the nursing home, remember all that money that they said that I owed? The nursing home voluntarily dismissed the lawsuit against me because I actually didn't owe them any money. So go figure. They actually ended up getting paid in full. So, you know, there were so many things that the newspapers didn't want to talk about. The voluntary dismissal of the nursing home's lawsuit against me, the unlawful death suit for the way that my mother died in the horrific conditions. But yet they were content to talk about a $17,000 misdemeanor and a misappropriation of funds, which, yes, landed me in a maximum security federal prison for 30 days. Figure that one out. Figure out how somebody gets a plea deal who's never had anything except the speeding ticket in her entire life, okay? Figure this one out and ends up in a maximum security prison for 30 days. I mean, the only word that rings to me here is corruption.
Yeah, and you were stuck because, you know, you're talking about the federal government. So even if you wanted, and I know this is something that you had to deal with your criminal defense attorney, it could have cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars, half a million dollars.
That was the estimate for a $17,000 misdemeanor. What do you do?
It's a misdemeanor. All right. So you got to go to camp for 30 days, which in itself is horrible. And what was horrible, what they did to you in the headlines.
I didn't get to go to camp, by the way, because they made sure when they sentenced me, they gave me 30 days instead of 31, because if they would have given me 31 days, they would have had to put me in a minimum security camp. But because they gave me 30 days, they got to put me in O-Town in FDC Miami, where, you know, you have an actual maximum security detention center. So I was my bunkie was there for manslaughter. I was there with murderers, gang members. Pretty much a whole different walk of life than white collar criminals.
How many people when you were in prison asked you what you were in for and laughed like, why are you here? Did you get that a lot in prison?
I did. And you know what else I got too? You know what else I got? And I thought it was crazy. Like, and this is actually, I'm in the midst of writing a second book, which is really good because it's a lot of the stories of these women and people I met and like the story of what actually happened once the doors closed. And I went in there and people were saying to me, they're going to beat the crap out of you. They're going to hate you because you're a Trump supporter. Look at you. You know, you're going to be somebody's, you know.
Yep.
See, I don't know what to say on the show.
You can say it. We're uncensored here, Karen.
Yeah, you know, you're going to be somebody's bitch, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I went in there and I really got to tell you something. I met a lot of really compassionate people.
Sure.
I met a lot of people that were in there unfairly. I met a lot of people that, you know, grew up in really bad socioeconomic environments and, you know, had turned to dealing drugs as a way to survive. I met, you know, a lot of women that I had things in common with. They were daughters, they were mothers, they were parents, they were, you know, people that made mistakes and made bad choices. And it was extremely relatable. And not one single person was obsessed with me for being a Trump supporter. And not one single person in there profiled me or treated me badly or made me their bitch. As a matter of fact, I had Fox News on the TV every day with an earpiece in my ear. And had really great discussions with a lot of the women there about what Donald Trump had done for prison reform and how he had helped their families and how they supported him because they saw positive change for America. So it was completely the opposite of what people thought it was going to be.
Well, thank God it was a good experience. You know, obviously, you go into something like that, sight unseen.
I mean,
I don't know
about good.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it wasn't good. No, it wasn't good. But it was an experience, and it's something that, you know, good or bad, life experience, in my opinion, is good. It's
I agree.
It's something you could share. What's the name of the second book going to be? From Beauty Pageant to Cell Block D?
I like that title. It's going to be Behind the Bars, but I like that title.
Behind the Bars.
Lot.
All right. That's good. Behind good. The good. Bars. So speaking of book. You wrote a book, your first book, which is coming out in October, I believe, right? Tell us the background of the book. When I was reading up on it, my wife, she's obsessed with the Epstein story and all of that whole Epstein Island and all the pedophile island and the Clintons and all that. And that was the first thing she zoned in on and said, we got to order this book. She saw Epstein. And I was like, that's intriguing. And I know a lot of the details, everyone has to read the book to find out a lot about that, but give us what you can about the book.
Oh, it's juicy. It's good. I mean, there's, you know, it's Palm Beach is a very interesting little microcosm. And I don't think I realized how interconnected Palm Beach was until I kind of ventured down this crazy journey that I was on, and the Epstein connections abounded from the magistrate in my case to my criminal defense lawyer. They had worked on the Epstein case together. There was some tension between them right before I was sentenced, some interesting things there that I talk about relating to the Epstein case and when he, you know, committed suicide right before I was sentenced. It's a wild ride. The book is really wild, and it blows the lid off of these connections, which are so prevalent here in Palm Beach and might really kind of escape other people that aren't from here, but they didn't escape me. And the more that I started to unravel this thing and I realized how all of these people were interconnected, the more interesting the story became. So there's Epstein connections within my sentencing and how things went down for me and my criminal defense attorney who worked on the Epstein case. There's a lot of that. There's also a very interesting story about the lawyers that actually came after me. Had I only Googled who they were, I would have known that they were hit with a $16.4 million jury trial judgment right around the time that they were coming after me and my mother. But I never thought to Google the law firm. It just wasn't. Right. I was worried about taking care of my mom, and come to find out they had this huge judgment that, you know, logically you would think to yourself, you know, that would stop any law firm from practicing. That would be, you know, that would take you down. You'd be out of business.
Sure.
But that just goes to show how much money is at stake in guardianships, because they're still practicing and still in the same business to this very day. And, you know, there's some really interesting connections there. The lawyer that, you know, was the head of this patriarch of this law firm, His grandfather, good old grandpappy, you know, was involved with the University of Florida and was there during, you know, desegregation and opposed it. And turns out his uncle was the state attorney down here in Palm Beach County for 30 wow. years. So, yeah, all of a sudden you start to realize that there's this whole tangled web of connections with these people. And it's all factual and it's all true. So I expose it all in the book and I talk about all of it. And, you know, it's an interesting story. You don't realize how connected, you know, our world is and what a small yeah. world it is in Palm Beach. And when you read this book, that's one of the things that'll really hit you over the head. But the other thing that I think is really important is something called historic recurrence. And historic recurrence is something that I see again and again in my life. And I think we see in politics every single day, which is where history repeats itself. And there's a lot of talk in my book about the way that I grew up and different things that happened to me growing up in the shadow of, you know, New York City when it was dubbed Fear City. You know, we're not so far from that today. We're seeing, you know, the pre-Giuliani emergence of New York now. And I see you have your Cuomo shirt on, so I know I'm preaching to the choir.
I'm a proud Cuomo-phobe.
Yeah, but, you know, part of the reason that I allowed the Guardian to be appointed is because growing up on those streets in New York with my mom and riding the subways, I was obsessed with the Guardian Angels growing up. I was obsessed with them. I thought that Guardian Angels were the saviors of freedom and America and sanity, and that they were the vigilantes on the street keeping us all safe. They were my real life superheroes.
Yeah.
So when I heard that there was going to be a Guardian appointed, in my mind, that was the picture that I had painted for myself, that this person was going to come in and was going to be a Guardian Angel of sorts. And boy, was I wrong. So yeah. I talk a lot about historic recurrence. You know, my parents came here escaping the Nazis. They both escaped the Nazis in Austria. And, you know, again, we can go down the slippery slope of what's happening in America today with our current administration and all of these things that are being implemented to push socialism. And, you know, that was exactly what drove Austria into an economic downturn that allowed the Nazis to come in and take yes. over power. In 1928, they had an election which allowed democratic socialism to come in. And once that happened, their economy was tanked and the Nazis were able to invade. And that's why the Jews were persecuted and my parents had to escape the country. So, you know, there's a lot of talk in my book about why I have the viewpoints that I do, but it's all based on my journey. And, you know, they say you don't understand a human being until you can walk in their shoes. I hope right. that the people watching this and listening to this will walk in my shoes for a minute and you'll learn a lot about America, a lot about my mom, and a lot about why, you know, I feel the way that I do.
And absolutely. And if anything else, if there's anybody that listens and watches and maybe has a similar situation where they have a parent in the nursing home system, maybe on that cognitive decline and they have their hands full, maybe based off your experience, it gives them a little insight to take a step back and look at the big picture and say, I really have to watch what's going on and make sure that my loved one is protected. And obviously that, you know, if you're protected, because it seems like there's nobody out there on that side that's truly looking to do the right thing for the family and for the patient. Like I said, my I despise nursing homes, and I have this I'm an only child. And I'm very close with my mother. She's young. She's in her 60s, and we have this joke. I says, you know, Mom, you got to be really nice to me. And she laughs. She goes, why? I says, because I get to pick what nursing home you go in. But I would never put my mother in a nursing home. I know nursing homes, they're luxurious now and beautiful, and they're building them like mad. But I just have that in my head. It's the dim hallway with the fluorescent bulb flashing at the end of it. And these old people are just rotting there and nobody cares about them, no matter how nice it looks. That's how I feel nursing homes are. But I know some people have no choice and they have to do that. Life is life. But what you went through, Twitter alone, I went through Twitter yesterday on your Twitter and I was going back to see what's the Twitterati. Man, I can't even – they talk about attacking you. And based off fake news, the narrative, you're a conservative – They're never going to report what's right. And then all of the other details, of course, they're going to leave out, like you said, because, well, they just don't like you. They don't like people like me. They don't like Donald Trump. I wanted to ask you, because I saw something that you were, you're in Florida, you're Governor Ron DeSantis, who's a huge and upcoming firebrand Republican. I mean, he's like the rock star. I happen to like a lot what he's doing. I'm curious to see what his next step is. But you were trying to lobby something with his office in regards to this?
Yeah, we were trying to lobby in a lot of states. I mean, we have these problems in 38 states in this country. Pretty much anywhere where you have elected judges, you have this level of corruption. You have this incestuous relationship between the guardianship system and lawyers. And we have to remember that the bar associations are really just peer review groups. They're not a legislative body. So we're having a hard time with the states policing this. So we've gone to Governor DeSantis. We've actually been trying to get with Attorney General Moody. We are talking to a lot of the states. I'm working with the Center for Estate Administration Reform, which is an organization called SEER. And we are looking to really get federal legislators involved to try to push federal legislation. And some of the things could be really easy. I had a conversation the other day. One of the things in my case that, you know, makes people's heads want to explode, including mine, is that the law firm represented both the guardian and the nursing home. They represented both of them. Now, any logical person would say to yourself, isn't that a conflict of interest?
Yeah,
but apparently legally it's not. So they were able to represent both the nursing home and the guardian, the nursing home that I was suing for neglect. They were able to represent both of them. So until we have even just a simple law that says, hey, the lawyer can't represent both the guardian and the nursing home, that would be something that could make major change. And it's a very simple thing to do. So we're looking at all these different angles to figure out what are some small steps we can take towards big change. And we're looking to get these things enacted on a federal level. And I'm talking to as many Congress people as I can and attorney generals and anybody that I can get their ear for 2 minutes. I tell them my story. And, you know, it comes from the heart because I'm in a situation where, you know, I spent 30 days in prison. I had a lot of time to think about, you know, what I would have done differently. You know, would I maybe have not put my mother in a nursing home? Yeah, maybe I wouldn't have done that. But my mom also had advanced dementia. And I was at the point where I couldn't properly take care of her. And, you know, there were a lot of factors at play. But, you know, we really have to get people involved to say, you know, no, we're not going to allow these attorneys to profit at the expense of the elderly. And that is what's happening. And it's happening legally. These attorneys did what they could do within the law in order to manipulate the system to make a profit. And there are lawyers doing this all over the country, and the system is allowing it.
There must be just money flying around everywhere. It's got to be millions and millions and millions and billions.
It's billions.
Billions
it's
of dollars.
Billions. It's I think the estimate's somewhere like at $3.8 billion in assets are being managed under guardianships in this country. And the reality is when you look at the guardianships and the people that are being placed in guardianships, you'll realize that it's very disparaging because you'll notice that the majority of the people that are being put in these guardianships are people that have assets and have ways for these attorneys to profit. You look at Britney Spears, you know, it's a good example because it's a very public example. Right. Her father is profiting. She's taking a salary of somewhere like $400,000 a year. Her lawyers are getting $1.5 million and her father's getting $1.5 million. So explain this to me. The celebrity is getting $400,000 and the lawyer and the father are getting upwards of $3 million a year.
How sick is that?
Sick. It's sick.
It's, you can't even, I can't even comprehend that. The talent.
It's twisted.
You know, I'm not a Britney Spears fan, but I read that story and her father is a degenerate for what he's doing, you know, to his daughter. He makes $5 million and Britney Spears at $400,000.
It's the whole thing's wild. I mean, that story in particular is wild, but there's so many of them. There is this man named Douglas Keegan. Douglas Keegan is in his 50s. His story's been pretty widely covered in Florida. He was put into a guardianship after his family objected to a woman that he had met online, and he had a family trust and there was money involved. And he had had some problems. He admittedly, you know, had some problems with alcohol and substance abuse throughout his life. But again, that doesn't mean that somebody loses their civil rights.
No.
And his civil rights were stripped from him. And basically, he was left living in a motel, riding a bicycle with a debit card that he could shop at certain stores on. And recently, he actually fought the system and had his rights restored. And he's a real success story. But you talk to this man. This man was a retired engineer. And the first time I talked to him, I thought, how is this even possible? How are you in this situation? And he was representing himself pro se, because what they do is they financially break these people to where they can't afford to fight back and they can't afford to have attorneys. And then they end up looking like crazy people in their own right because they're trying to fight these cases on their own. I mean, it's just such a very twisted, bizarre system. And it leaves, you know, the kids of these elderly people looking like a bunch of conspiracy theorists. And, you know, unfortunately, it's all very true and it's happening every day in this country. And, you know, this is a bipartisan issue. You know, even I try to get across to people, I'm like, you know, even if you don't like me, you don't like my politics, you still might be a mom, you still might be a daughter, you still may be able to find commonalities with me that you didn't know were there. And one of the best things that happened to me recently is the editor who's editing my book for Post Hill Press wrote me a letter. And the letter was basically, hey, I read your book. We probably don't agree politically, but I found a lot of things we had in common. And that was how she opened up the letter to me. And I thought, that is exactly what I want to achieve with this book. I want people to look past the politics, understand the politics, understand why I am who I am, and maybe why I was targeted and why this happened to me. But look beyond it and realize, you know what, at the end of the day, we're all human beings. I'm a product of two wonderful parents that came to this country escaping socialism and escaping communism and came here for a better life and built that life and helped me build this beautiful life in America. And that's also part of the story.
Right. And it is important to, in a situation like this, and that's a great letter to that they looked past the politics. And it just reminds me of, I like to talk about politics with anybody and everybody, whether we don't agree or not. And this is something that if I talk to a liberal, someone on the radical left, whatever it is, I want to hear everything they say. And I say to myself in my head, I want them to sell me something. I want a bite. Maybe they have something that I can agree with or we can have some commonality. Doesn't happen that often, but I like to listen. But then what I find is being a conservative is when I give my view just in a discussion and then it gets to the point where they don't agree, usually by the time I start talking, they already have it in their head that no, 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 no. And then the hostility starts. This is a problem, especially, and it's a left problem. When you don't agree with somebody or having a conversation with a political conversation and it gets to that disagreement point, they go on the attack. Like they attack your humanity. They call you things like, well, you're a Trumper. You're a white supremacist. You're a this and you're a that. And they go to name calling. And it's all because we can't agree on politics. And then I tell them, well, that's great that we can share opinions because this is America and it's about free thinking and freedom of speech. What's not okay is the disgusting venom spraying from the left that and the media that tries to make people like you look like villains when you're not. And it's that non-objective journalism, because you know journalism is dead. It's they're all activists. It's all opinion-based media, and that obviously that goes for both sides. We have right-leaning media now, and I watch them all. And that just report the facts and let us, the people, come up with our opinions based on the facts, not the opinions, not your activism when Don Lemon is sitting there on CNN calling all white Republicans racists. You know, no, Don Lemon, you're an asshole. So
he's making $10 million a year to spew that bullshit. So, you know, everybody needs to realize the guy is honestly a puppet. He's, you know, I don't even think he really believes the things that he says, but he sold his soul for money. And it's the same thing. Look at, you know, look at Chris Cuomo. It's exactly the same situation. Oh, these people are overpaid. They're making a ton of money. They've sold their souls to, you know, the almighty dollar, and they're willing to say whatever. And, you know, the left thrives on divisiveness, you know, and most people, I don't think, are extreme leftists, just like most people aren't extreme on the right. Most people are relatively moderate. But the way that the media and the left-sided media is winning is by creating this environment of tension and anger and divisiveness. And, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of Americans that are buying into it. And those are the same Americans that are name-calling me on Twitter, as you can see when you go into my Twitter feed. Same people that are managing, you know, blog websites about me, which still blows my mind that there are people that actually spend their time blogging about me. Apparently there's one website where I'm a bigamist, which I didn't know about, but I thought it was made me a little bit more interesting, quite frankly. It's wild.
You're living rent free in all of their heads. I would feel honored if somebody started a hate blog about Alan Jacoby. To me, it's a badge of honor.
It kind of is a badge of honor. I will give you that. I have to look at it that way.
You have to, because Karen, it's never going to stop. You're a conservative. You're writing a book that's not out yet. Wait till that book's out. You think the hate's not going to stop? It may elevate. It's going to elevate from those people that were pushing that negative narrative that you're a monster. And to be honest, I can't wait for that to happen to you. You know why? Because it's going to make your book sell. Mm-hmm. And this whole cancel culture, when they're going woke, they're going broke, and it's affecting them, and they're seeing it. I don't believe in cancel culture. I didn't boycott Nike because that clown took a knee on the field. I happen to like Nike, whatever it is, because I don't believe in the cancel culture. I don't, because that's a disgusting leftism thing. And the Nazis revolutionized cancel culture when they had the Boycott the Jews project, when they Hitler sure came in and canceled it. You cannot deal with Jew businesses. You can't do business with Jews, nothing. And then they disarmed them, and then boom, look what happened. And that's, we're seeing that today, because make no mistake, I truly believe that the AOCs of the world and these other sick leftists would love nothing more to see people like you and me getting packed into a boxcar going somewhere to take that last shower. You know what I mean?
Oh, they definitely would. There's no question about that. Absolutely. And again, you know, you could go back to the headlines about me and just the vitriol, the absolute vitriol towards who I am personally, you know. And I mean, we can get in. I'm a Jewish woman. You know, I competed for Mrs. Florida. I don't know if there's ever been a Jewish Mrs. Florida before. There's all these things that could be celebrated, yet all of that's been negated because the only thing that they wanted to focus on is she's a Trump supporter and we don't like her and she's a criminal. And that was it. And it was just completely like, just let's ignore all of the facts. Let's ignore everything else and let's cancel her entirely. And, you know, I think people really are seeing through it. I think they've gone so far that they pushed my situation. You know, thank God it was as salacious as it was, because had I been a typical $17,000 misdemeanor criminal with no criminal record, I would have gotten 6 months of probation and nobody would have given a shit. They would have been like, she got probation. Yeah, okay, it's over with. But because they pushed it as far as they did, and the headlines became so outrageous, and then of course I ended up in this maximum security prison, people are like, oh shit, like I want to hear what happened. How the hell did that happen?
Right.
So, you know, I have to see the silver lining and I have to find something to be thankful for in all of this, especially because of everything they put my mother through. And the thing that I choose to be thankful for is the fact that they actually have gotten so crazy and pushed these narratives so far and so ridiculous that people are like, wait a minute, what's really going on? you know, Matt Gaetz is a perfect example of this also.
Yes.
And, you know, the shots that they're taking at this guy right now, you know, here he was just about a month ago. He was the darling of our party. I mean, he was positioned to be the next JFK of the Republican Party. And all of a sudden now there's a sex scandal, and then there's marijuana, and there's this. They've pulled every salacious thing that they can and wrapped it up into this box of nonsense.
Yes.
And who knows what little bit might be true or might have some truth.
Right.
They're trying to cancel this guy and slaughter this guy. And, you know, I don't know what the truth is, but I would bet you that there's very small shreds of truth in that story,
right,
that the majority of it is completely fake news.
And I hope so. And that's if there is investigations, let the investigations play out. If he is guilty of horrible things, then it is what it is. He's got to face that. I'm on board with you. I don't think any of it's true. The guy was a young single guy. He partied. I don't think that any girls were underage. That's my belief. He is one of those firebrand Republicans. And now, of course, you know, you get the Rhino Republicans that are kind of taking a step back from him. But I think when this all comes out and it is nonsense again, I think that's going to elevate him and it's going to help him. Look at the other one that they want to get rid of, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Oh, yeah. She's great, by the way. I've met her. I've had lunch with her. I've actually met both of them. I've been really lucky the past year. I've met some great people. She's amazing.
I emailed her office and I got a response back. You know, I'm a big Second Amendment guy. She's big Second Amendment. I'd love to get 20 minutes with her on my show because she does her live videos every day. And cause I know if I got her talking for 20 minutes, we'd probably talk for an hour. And I think she's amazing because she has balls. And I was on somebody's show today, the Joe Cozzo show, who's has a similar show like mine, Conservative Politics. And we were talking about that, and he said the Republican Party does not have balls right now as a party.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. Kevin McCarthy, you know, but then there are people in the party that are up and coming. Hopefully more people that will primary some of these rhinos and get in and elevate the Republican Party. Curious to see what Ron DeSantis does. Curious to see what Donald Trump does. And it's about your book. I wanted to ask you, because this really stood out at me, and I didn't notice it right away until I had to take a double take. So Roger Stone wrote the foreword.
He did. Yeah.
All right. Can you kind of enlighten me that connection? Because I love the man, and I would love to talk to him for 10 minutes. I love him. How is that connection that he wrote the foreword?
He's amazing. We became friends. I've known Roger for a number of years through different political connections, and he became a friend and a large part a mentor. I really respect him. I've watched what he's gone through and how he's been persecuted. And
sure,
he was one of the first people that was there for me when stuff started to go down for me. I knew that this was happening. I was out fundraising for him. I was trying to help him with his legal problems.
Yeah.
And we had dinner and I said, you know, they're going to be all over me. The media is going to go crazy. This is going to be a huge story. I know that, you know, this is going to go down tomorrow and I'm scared. And he looked at me and he said, he goes, why they hate us? They hate us because we make a difference. Don't ever stop doing what you're doing and do not let them silence you. And
I love it.
He was 100% right. And it was, you know, I found a lot of strength in my friendship with him. And I have. I mean, he's been a great friend to me and somebody who has unconditionally been there for me and supported me and cheerleaded for me and, you know, said, hey, you're going to be okay. You're going to be all right. You're going to get through this. And,
yeah,
you know, when you're in a time of crisis, you realize who your friends are. And I can tell you that I have a lot of political friends and a lot of my political rhino friends weren't really there for me when push came to shove. It was, ooh, Karen Turk, we don't want to be closely connected to you anymore now that there's controversy.
You're tainted.
But, you know,
you're tainted.
Yeah, you're tainted. Ooh.
Yeah.
But, you know, people like Roger and my true friends were like, we don't care. We know who you are. You're my friend and I care about you. Are you okay? What can I do for you? And that's right. the kind of friend that he's been. And I was absolutely over the moon that he was willing to write my forward. And, you know, I got a little choked up when I read it, because you could tell it comes from the heart. And it truly is something that, you know, I would have never expected. I would have never expected him to do that for me. But that's the kind of friend that he is. And I will always have a huge amount of respect for Roger. They drag him through the mud. He gets back up. He keeps on fighting, and he is an absolutely brilliant human being. One of the smartest men I've ever met.
Yeah, he intrigues me, and I feel bad. I keep saying I have to get his books, and I haven't. It just, you know, it's laziness. But when I'm done with this show today, I'm ordering his books and your book because I can't wait to read them. And again, Roger Stone, I'm a huge fan, and please. When you talk to him, tell him that he is a big fan here at the Great Divide podcast. And if he ever wants to, come on and promote a book or talk about any experiences, I would roll out the red carpet for him. You know,
I would recommend that you read Stone's Rules. Stone's Rules is one of my favorite books of his.
Okay.
And his rule number 99 is a rule to live by. And that rule is never miss an opportunity to have sex or be on television.
I think I like him even more.
It's great. He's great. And his sense of humor is fantastic. And he's somebody who really is, you know, despite all of the fake news and this crazy evil persona that they've painted, this is a man who's an incredible father, incredible grandfather, and an incredible friend.
Yeah, and they make him out to look like a villain. Just, you know, they mm-hmm. made you to look like a villain, and it's just not true. You can tell. Just having a conversation and looking into the facts, you know, you can see through the bullshit. Before we wrap up, I want you to let everybody know how they can pre-order the book, and also I know you have a conservative radio show and your social media. How can people learn more about Karen Turk and get the book?
Well, I would love if your viewers would follow me on Instagram at Mrs. Florida 2016. I'm also now on Parler. I'm not doing a terribly good job with it. So anybody who could follow me on Parler, I'd really appreciate it. I'm going to make an effort. And you can pre-order the book on Amazon. It's also on my website, which is www.karynturk.com, and you can go there and pre-order the book. And I hope everybody wants to hear the story behind the headlines, because it's a good one. And my show each week on iHeart, Behind the Headlines, we go behind the headlines of the hottest stories, everything from Matt Gaetz, who I covered a few weeks ago, to Roger Stone and any other stories that are trending, and we get back to the bottom of the truth.
That's great. I'm going to all of your social media, all of Karen's social media, the Amazon Prime link to pre-order the book, her website, it's KarenTurk.com, right?
KarenTurk.com. And that's the real one. If you get on the wrong one and it says the ugly truth about Karen Turk, then you know that's not my website.
I'm probably going to want to read that one too, guys.
You are. It's good. I won't even lie. It's good. It's entertaining. It's good for a minute or two.
All your information is going to be in the show notes. So anybody, just go into the show notes, wherever you listened to and watched it, and it'll be there. And just like anything else, you can catch this episode and all the other episodes of The Great Divide on all podcast platforms, YouTube. You can go right to the website to follow all the social media of the show at thegreatdivide1776.com. Karen, I can't thank you enough for being here. I can't wait to read the book. Now we have to wait till October for it to come out. And I hear your dog. I hear your dog.
I was just saying, my dog is really excited about the book as well.
He must be.
My dog is plugging the book.
my dog barked. If he barked, he drowned us out. I have a 105-pound German Shepherd. But,
oh, wow. Well, that's a 5.8-pound sheep poo. So she's half Shih Tzu and half poodle. Yeah, I don't know why she's doing that, but
she's happy. She's happy. She knows
she
the book's
happy.
Coming out. She's a conservative dog. We were talking about
she
a
is.
Lot of good stuff, and there you go. Listen, Karen, again, thank you so much for being here and sharing your story. I can't wait to read it. Please go get the book, the Behind the Headlines by Karen Turk. Everything will be in the show notes. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And most of all, God bless America. Take care, everybody. You can reach out to me with opinions and ideas for other episodes at thegreatdivide1776@gmail.com. You can also find me on social media at The Great Divide Podcast. And please be sure to leave a review for this podcast so the show can be shared to other listeners. Thank you, and God bless America.